Here's something written by Robert Lake. Dear teacher, I would like to introduce you to my son, Wind Wolf. He is probably what you would consider a typical Indian kid. He was born and raised on the reservation. He has black hair, dark brown eyes, and an olive complexion. And like so many Indian children his age, he is shy and quiet in the classroom. He is 5 years old, in kindergarten, and I can't understand why you have already labeled him a slow learner. At the age of 5, he has already been through quite an education compared with his peers in Western society. As his first introduction into this world, he was bonded to his mother and to the Mother Earth in a traditional native childbirth ceremony. And he has been continuously cared for by his mother, father, sisters, cousins, aunts, uncles, grandparents, and extended tribal family since this ceremony. From his mother's warm and loving arms, Wind Wolf was placed in a secure and specially designed Indian baby basket. His father and the medicine elders conducted another ceremony with him that served to bond him with the essence of his genetic father, the Great Spirit, the grandfather Sun, and the grandmother Moon. This was all done to introduce him properly into the new and natural world, not the world of artificiality, and to protect his sensitive and delicate soul. It is our people's way of showing the newborn respect, ensuring that he starts his life on the path of spirituality. The traditional Indian baby basket became his turtle shell and served as the first seat for his classroom. He was strapped in for safety, protected from injury by the willow roots and hazelwood construction. The basket was made by a tribal elder who had gathered her materials with prayer and in a ceremonial way. It is the same kind of basket that our people have used for thousands of years. It is specially designed to provide the child with the kind of knowledge and experience he will need to survive in his culture and environment. Wind Wolf was strapped in snugly with a deliberate restriction upon his arms and legs. Although you in Western society may argue that such a method serves to hinder motor skill development and abstract reasoning, we believe it forces the child to first develop his intuitive faculties, rational intellect, symbolic thinking, and 5 senses. Wind Wolf was with his mother constantly, closely bonded physically, as she carried him on her back or held him in front while breastfeeding. She carried him everywhere she went, and every night he slept with both parents. Because of this, Wind Wolf's educational setting was not only a secure environment, but it was also very colorful, complicated, sensitive, and diverse. He has been with his mother at the ocean at daybreak, when she made her prayers and gathered fresh seaweed from the rocks. He has sat with his uncles in a rowboat on the river while they fished with gill nets, and he has watched and listened to elders as they told creation stories and animal legends and sang songs around the campfires. He has attended the sacred and ancient white deerskin dance of his people and is well acquainted with the cultures and languages of other tribes. He has been with his mother when she gathered herbs for healing and watched his tribal aunts and grandmothers gather and prepare traditional foods such as acorn, smoked salmon, eel, and deer meat. He has played with abalone shells, pine nuts, iris grass string, and leather while watching the women make beaded jewelry and traditional native regalia. He has had many opportunities to watch his father, uncles, and ceremonial leaders use different kinds of colorful feathers and sing different kinds of songs while preparing for the sacred dances and rituals. As he grew older, Wind Wolf began to crawl out of the baby basket, develop his motor skills, and explore the world around him. When frightened or sleepy, he could always return to the basket as a turtle withdraws into its shell. Such an inward journey allows one to reflect in privacy on what he has learned and to carry the new knowledge deeply into the unconscious and the soul. Shapes, sizes, colors, texture, sound, smell, feeling, taste, and the learning process are therefore functionally integrated. The physical and spiritual, matter and energy, conscious and unconscious, individual and social. This kind of learning goes beyond the basics of distinguishing the difference between rough and smooth, square and round, hard and soft, black and white, similarities and extremes. For example, Windwolf was with his mother in South Dakota while she danced for 7 days straight in the hot sun, fasting and piercing herself in the sacred sun dance ceremony of a distant tribe. He has been doctored in a number of different healing ceremonies by medicine men and women from diverse places, ranging from Alaska and Arizona to New York and California. He has been in more than 20 different sacred sweat lodge rituals used by native tribes to purify mind, body, and soul since he was 3 years old, and he has already been exposed to many different religions of his racial brothers, Protestant, Catholic, Asian Buddhist, and Tibetan Lamaist. It takes a long time to absorb and reflect on these kinds of experiences, so maybe that is why you think my Indian child is a slow learner. His aunts and grandmothers taught him to count and know his numbers while they sorted out the complex materials used to make the abstract designs in the native baskets. He listened to his mother count each and every bead and sort out numerically according to color while she painstakingly made complex beaded belts and necklaces. He learned his basic numbers by helping his father count and sort the rocks to be used in the sweat lodge. 7 rocks for a medicine sweat, say, or 13 for the summer solstice ceremony. The rocks are later heated and doused with water to create purifying steam. And he was taught to learn mathematics by counting the sticks we use in our traditional native hand game. So I realize he may be slow in grasping the methods and tools that you are now using in your classrooms, ones quite familiar to his white peers. But I hope you will be patient with him. It takes time to adjust to a new cultural system and learn new things. He is not culturally disadvantaged, but he is culturally different. If you ask him how many months there are in a year, he will probably tell you 13. He will respond this way not because he doesn't know how to count properly, but because he has been taught by our traditional people that there are 13 full moons in a year according to the native tribal calendar, and that there are really 13 planets in our solar system and 13 tail feathers on a perfectly balanced eagle, the most powerful kind of bird to use in ceremony and healing. But he also knows that some eagles may have only 12 tail feathers, or 7, that they do not all have the same number. He knows that the flicker has exactly 10 tail feathers. They are red and black, representing the directions of east and west, life and death, and that this bird is considered a fire bird, a power used in native doctoring and healing. He can probably count more than 40 different kinds of birds, tell you and his peers what kind of bird each is and where it lives, the seasons in which it appears, and how it is used in a sacred ceremony. He may have trouble writing his name on a piece of paper, but he knows how to say it and many other things in several different Indian languages. He is not fluent yet because he is only 5 years old and required by law to attend your educational system, learn your language, your values, your ways of thinking, and your methods of teaching and learning. So you see, all of these influences together make him somewhat shy and quiet, and perhaps slow according to your standards. But if Wind Wolf was not prepared for his first tentative foray into your world, neither were you appreciative of his culture. On the first day of class, you had difficulty with his name. You wanted to call him Wind, insisting that Wolf somehow must be his middle name. The students in the class laughed at him, causing further embarrassment. While you are trying to teach him your new methods, helping him learn new tools for self-discovery and adapt to his new learning environment, he may be looking out the window as if daydreaming. Why? Because he has been taught to watch and study the changes in nature. It is hard for him to make the appropriate psychic switch from the right to the left hemisphere of the brain when he sees the leaves turning bright colors and the geese heading south and the squirrels scurrying around for nuts to get ready for a harsh winter. In his heart, in his young mind, and almost by instinct, he knows that this is the time of year he is supposed to be with his people, gathering and preparing fish, deer meat, and native plants and herbs, and learning his assigned tasks in this role. He is caught between two worlds, torn by two distinct cultural systems. Yesterday, for the third time in 2 weeks, he came home crying and said he wanted to have his hair cut. He said he doesn't have any friends at school because they make fun of his long hair. I tried to explain to him that in our culture, long hair is a sign of masculinity and balance and is a source of power, but he remained adamant in his position. To make matters worse, he recently encountered his first harsh case of racism. Wind Wolf had managed to adopt at least one good school friend. On the way home from school one day, he asked his new pal if he wanted to come home to play with him until supper. That was okay with Wind Wolf's mother, who was walking with them. When they all got to the little friend's house, the two boys ran inside to ask permission while Wind Wolf's mother waited. But the other boy's mother lashed out. "It is okay if you have to play with him at school, but we don't allow those kind of people in our house." When my wife asked why not, the other boy's mother answered, "Because you are Indians, and we are white, and I don't want my kids growing up with your kind of people." So now my young Indian child does not want to go to school anymore, even though we did cut his hair. He feels that he does not belong. He is the only Indian child in your class, and he is well aware of this fact. Instead of being proud of his race, heritage, and culture, he feels ashamed. When he watches television, he asks why the white people hate us so much and always kill our people in the movies, and why they take everything away from us. He asks why the other kids in school are not taught about the power, beauty, and essence of nature, or provided with an opportunity to experience the world around them firsthand. He says he hates living in the city and that he misses his Indian cousins and friends. He asks why one white girl at school, who is a friend, always tells him, "I like you, Wind Wolf, because you are a good Indian." Now he refuses to sing his native songs, play with his Indian artifacts, learn his language, or participate in his sacred ceremonies. When I ask him to go to an urban powwow or help me with a sacred sweat lodge ritual, he says no, because that's weird, and he doesn't want his friends at school to think he doesn't believe in God. So, dear teacher, I want to introduce you to my son, Wind Wolf, who is not really a typical kid after all. He stems from a long line of hereditary chiefs, medicine men and women, and ceremonial leaders whose accomplishments and unique forms of knowledge are still being studied and recorded in contemporary books. He has 7 different tribal systems flowing through his blood. He is even part white. I want my child to succeed in school and in life. I don't want him to be a dropout or juvenile delinquent or to end up on drugs and alcohol because he is made to feel inferior or because of discrimination. I want him to be proud of his rich heritage and culture, and I would like him to develop the necessary capabilities to adapt to and succeed in both cultures. But I need your help. What you say and what you do in the classroom, what you teach and how you teach it, and what you don't say and don't teach will have a significant effect on the potential success or failure of my child. Please remember that this is the primary year of his education and development. All I ask is that you work with me, not against me, to help educate my child in the best way. If you don't have the knowledge, preparation, experience, or training to effectively deal with culturally different children, I am willing to help you with the few resources I have available or direct you to such resources. Millions of dollars have been appropriated by Congress and are being spent each year for Indian education. All you have to do is take advantage of it and encourage your school to make an effort to use it in the name of equal education. My Indian child has a constitutional right to learn, retain, and maintain his heritage and culture. By the same token, I strongly believe that non-Indian children also have a constitutional right to learn about our Native American heritage and culture, because Indians play a significant part in the history of Western society. Until this reality is equally understood and applied in education as a whole, there will be a lot more school children in grades K through 12 identified as slow learners. My son, Windwolf, is not an empty glass coming into your class to be filled. He is a full basket coming into a different environment and society with something special to share. Please let him share this knowledge, heritage, and culture with you and his peers. That was written by Robert Lake in 1990. During the planning stage for the construction of a new condominium in Hino City, Tokyo, the prospective residents had a heated debate on whether or not an elevator should be installed. Some were opposed because it would consume energy, guaranteeing carbon dioxide emissions. Others were in favor, insisting that elderly people living on the top floors would need it. In spring 2001, a slow elevator was the solution. They agreed to install an elevator that is slower than walking. Young people wouldn't want to wait for the elevator, while elderly people could use it if they wanted to, since they are not usually in a rush. As expected, the slow elevator is now used only by the elderly, and it consumes much less energy than a conventional elevator. Here's a news report from 1998 from Salt Lake City, Utah. Almost 3 years after the school board banned extracurricular clubs to get rid of a gay students group, the target of the ban is thriving, and East High School, where the Gay-Straight Alliance so unsettled officials, is hurting. Dozens of clubs disbanded, including Students Against Drunk Driving, the Crazy E Pep Club, Young Republicans, Young Democrats, and several that promoted ethnic awareness, as well as groups that celebrated Bart Simpson, UFOs, and the joys of eating beef. School spirit has evaporated, students socialize less, and class and racial rifts are deeper than before, say students and teachers. People don't care about school anymore, said cheerleader Chris Trindell. It's been a disaster, said Scott Nelson, a social studies and history teacher. There's more to education than just the curriculum. There's a certain social element, he said. The turmoil began in 1995 with a student request for school sanction of a support group for homosexual teens, the Gay-Straight Alliance. The state legislature quickly lined up in opposition and began a contentious period of hearings that culminated in spring 1996 with passage of a bill banning school clubs that encourage criminal or delinquent conduct, bigotry, or sexual behavior. The bill was eventually incorporated into State Board of Education rules approved the following winter. But the Salt Lake School Board wasn't waiting for state guidance. Advised that federal law prohibits schools from discriminating against clubs on the basis of unpopular ideas they espouse, but unwilling to stomach the Gay-Straight Alliance, the board in February 1996 banished all clubs not linked to academic studies in the city's four high schools. The Gay-Straight Alliance survived because it had the guidance and support of the politically savvy Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network, a national gay rights group. Now, under sponsorship of the network, the Alliance meets as a community group and pays $6 an hour to rent an East High School classroom one afternoon a week. Other clubs died for lack of adult volunteers and the money to pay rent and insurance premiums. The few groups still allowed, science, math, and language clubs, along with athletic, debate, and drama teams, attract mostly college-bound students. According to science teacher Camille Lee, the students hurt the most are those with tenuous after-school links to the school. Here's a piece from Canadian Geographic magazine from 1998. The Quiet of the Backstretch by David Helwig. Pinet Raceway is hidden in a small patch of woods not far from our big frame house. You get there by turning down a clay road just past Mike's Lobster Pound on the Trans-Canada Highway, about 40 kilometers east of Charlottetown. There's a handmade sign for the track, the outline of a horse, driver, and sulky. The raceway has a wooden grandstand, a frame building with a snack bar, and, farther off, a longer, lower building with stalls for the horses. Everything is painted white with green trim. The oval of the track is the red ochre of Prince Edward Island earth. When you climb into the grandstand, you look across at a stand of tall spruce that runs half the length of the backstretch. The other half opens across fields to the shining surface of the Pinet River. Sometimes I have seen the quick, short beat of an osprey's wings as it circles over the water, hunting, waiting to dive. On the quiet of the backstretch between races, I have seen a fox trot by on its dainty feet, out of the spruce woods and back in. Most of those who come to the track live close by. A girl of 16 takes your dollar admission on the way in, and a few minutes later, she turns up in the grandstand selling tickets for the night's raffle. There's no rush to the betting windows here. There are no betting windows. No purse for the winner, either. The races are just for the fun of racing, for the pleasure of seeing the long, delicate legs moving in harmony, pulling the slender wheels of the carts twice around the oval. When they want to groom the track after the first couple of races, a tractor pulls out from behind the horse barn with the trunk of a good-sized spruce tree on a chain behind it, and the log is dragged over the bright earth to level it. The snack bar has hot dogs and chips and homemade muffins, sold by the kind of women you might run into at a church tea. In fact, the worlds aren't far apart. A woman just along the row in the grandstand is talking about a minister she's just heard. Some kind of a Baptist, she's certain. She could tell by the way he preached. And as the horses in the third race battle toward the wire, the announcer calls out, "Sing your favorite hymns!" A Wednesday evening, and we are sitting in the stands. It is late summer, the end of the season. A chill is in the air. One of the horsemen, a familiar face from earlier Wednesdays, jokes that he's coming up into the seats to get warm. "That one's a good little goer," he says of a 2-year-old pacing down the backstretch. No one comments, and he says it again. "That one's a good little goer." The race card is not planned too much in advance. A driver will stop his horse in front of the grandstand to shout up to the race announcer the name of a new arrival, then tell those of us watching that he has to go back to the stables to get his whip since someone has mislaid it. Between races, the driver who won the first appears among the spectators, still in the helmet, which is his only racing gear. He's a small, thin man with a smiling face. When they find themselves short of entries for the third race, he takes his horse out again. He wins again. Tonight, the second race had only two horses in it, and neither driver was carrying a whip. You could hear their voices across the darkening air, shouting encouragement at their horses as they came down the home stretch. There are no lights on the Pinette track, so the races have to be over before dark comes up out of the east, over the river and the tall trees. Will there be races next week? Maybe. But the days are getting short. The air is sharp with cold. After the last race, everyone is quick to get up and move to the cars. The sun is setting over the cove at Pinette, and the beach, where we dug clams in the summer, is empty. At this time of year, the lobster boats are brought ashore and set on blocks to pass the winter, then to be painted and cleaned up when the weather warms up in spring. It is part of the poetry of fall here, the boats appearing in the yards of houses down every country road. Soon, they'll be taking down the sign announcing the races, but in a few months, when the ice is out, among the other signs of spring on the island, the horses will be back, their hooves banging along over the red earth. That was by David Helwig, who lives on Prince Edward Island, Canada. A couple of hundred people gathered at the state capitol in Sacramento recently to protest Indian gambling in cities, the subject of two initiatives on the November ballot. But the rally turned into a different kind of demonstration when the crowd, made up mostly of homeless people, street gang members, and self-described anarchists, demanded money they were owed for showing up. "We don't know who is paying us," one young man from the San Francisco area told Indian Country Today newspaper. "All we know is that we were told to get on a bus and we would get $40. When no money was immediately produced, tempers grew hot, and African-American youths and anarchists started shouting at each other over their clothing choices. Payment for appearing at the rally, the paper said, was apparently promised by some of the nonprofit groups that oppose urban casinos. Here's a story by Ron Carlson, included in his book of stories, The News of the World. The H Street Sledding Record. The last thing I do every Christmas Eve is go out in the yard and throw the horse manure onto the roof. It is a ritual. After we return from making our attempt at the H Street Sledding Record, and we sit in the kitchen sipping eggnog and listening to Elise recount the sled ride, and Elise then finally goes to bed happily, reluctantly, and we finish placing Elise's presents under the tree, and we pin her stocking to the mantel, with care, and Drew brings out two other wrapped boxes, which anyone could see are for me, and I slap my forehead, having forgotten to get her anything at all for Christmas, except the prizes hidden behind the glider on the front porch, I go into the garage, and put on the gloves, and then into the yard, where I throw the horse manure on the roof. Drew always uses this occasion to call my mother. They exchange all the Christmas news, but the main purpose of the calls, the last few years, has been for Drew to stand in the window where she can see me out there lobbing the great turds up into the snow on the roof, and describe what I am doing to my mother. The two women take amusement from this. They say things like, "You married him," and "He's your son." I take their responses to my rituals as a kind of fond, subtle support, which it is. Drew has said, when she first discovered me throwing the manure on the roof, the the Christmas that Elise was for. You're the only man I've ever known who did that. See, a compliment. But now that Elise is 8, Drew has become cautious. You're fostering her fantasies. I answer, kids grow up too soon these days. And then Drew has this. What do you want her to do? Come home from school in tears when she's 15? Some kid in her class will have said, oh, sure, Santa's reindeer shit on your roof, huh? All I can say to Drew then is, some kid in her class, fine, I don't care what he says, I'm her father. I have thrown horse manure on our roof for 4 years now, and I plan to do it every Christmas Eve until my arm gives out. It satisfies me as a homeowner to do so, for the wonderful amber stain that is developing between the swamp cooler and the chimney and is visible all spring, summer, fall as you drive down the hill by our house, and for the way the two rose bushes by the gutter spout have raged into new and profound growth during the milder months. And as a father, it satisfies me as a ritual that keeps my family together. Drew has said, you want to create evidence? Let's put out milk in a cookie and then drink the milk and eat a bite out of the cookie. I looked at her. Drew, I had said, I don't like cookies. I never ate a dessert in my life. And like I said, Drew has been a good sport. Even the year I threw one gob short and ran a hideous smear down the kitchen window screen that hovered over all of us until March, when I was able to take it down and go to the car wash. I obtained the manure from my friend Bob, more specifically from his horse, Power, who lives just west of Heber. I drive out there the week before Christmas and retrieve about a bushel. I throw it on the roof a lump at a time, wearing a pair of welding gloves my father gave me. I put the brake on the sled in 1975, when Drew was pregnant with Elise, so we could still make our annual attempt on the H Street record on Christmas Eve. It was the handle of a broken Louisville Slugger baseball bat, and still had the precise 34 stamped into the bottom. I sawed it off square and drilled and bolted it to the rear of the sled so that when I pulled back on it, the stump would drag us to a stop. As it turned out, it was one of the 2 years when there was no snow, so we walked up to 11th Avenue and H Street, as we promised, rain or shine, sat on the flexible flyer in the middle of the dry street on a starry Christmas Eve, and I held her in my lap. We sat on the sled like two basketball players contesting possession of her belly. We talked a little about what it would be like when she took her leave from the firm and I had her home all day with the baby, and we talked remotely about whether we wanted any more babies, and we talked about the record, which was set on December 24, 1969, the first Christmas of our marriage, when we lived in the neighborhood, on Fifth Avenue, in an old barn of a house, the total rent on which was $72.50, honest, and Drew had given me the sled that very night, and we had walked out about midnight and been surprised by the blizzard. No wonder we took the sled and walked around the corner up H Street, up, up, up to 11th Avenue, and without speaking or knowing what we were doing, opening the door on the second ritual of our marriage, the annual sled ride. The first ritual was the word condition, and the activities it engendered in our droopy old bed. At the top, we scanned the city, blurred in snow, sat on my brand new Christmas sled, and set off. The sled rode high and effortlessly through the deep snow, and suddenly, as our hearts started and our eyes began to burn against the snowy air, we were going faster than we'd planned. We crossed 10th Avenue, nearly taking flight in the dip, and then descended in a dark rush, 9th, 8th, 7th, soaring across each avenue, my arms wrapped around Drew like a straitjacket to drag her off with me if a car should cross in front of us on 6th, 5th Avenue, 4th. This all took seconds, do you see? Until a car did turn onto H Street, headed our way, and we veered the new sled sharply, up over the curb, dousing our speed in the snowy yard, one house from the corner of 3rd Avenue. Drew took a real face full of snow, which she squirmed around and pressed into my neck, saying the words, "Now, that's a record!" And it was the record, 11th to 3rd, and it stood partly because there had been two Christmas Eves with no snow, partly because of assorted spills brought on by too much speed, too much laughter, sometimes too much caution, and by a light blue Mercedes that crossed 6th Avenue just in front of us in 1973. And though some years were flops, there was nothing about Christmas that Elise looked forward to as much as our one annual attempt at the H Street sledding record. I think Drew wants another baby. I'm not sure, but I think she wants another child. The signs are so subtle, they barely seem to add up. But she says things like, "Remember before Elise went to school?" And, "There sure are a lot of women in their mid-30s having babies." I should ask her. But for some reason, I don't. We talk about everything. Everything. But I've avoided this topic. I've avoided talking to Drew about this topic because I want another child too badly to have her not want one. I want a little boy to come into the yard on Christmas morning and say, "See, there on the roof, the reindeers were there." I want another kid to throw horse manure for. I'll wait. It will come up one of these days. I'll find a way to bring it up. Christmas is coming. Every year, on the day after Halloween, I tip the sled out of the rafters in the garage, and Elise and I sponge it off, clean the beautiful dark blonde wood with furniture polish, enamel the nicked spots on the runner supports with black engine paint, and rub the runners themselves with waxed paper. It is a ritual done on the same plaid blanket in the garage, and it takes all afternoon. When we are finished, we lean the sled against the wall, and Elise marches into the house. "Okay now," she says to her mother. "Let it snow." On the first Friday night in December, every year, Elise and Drew and I go by our tree. This, too, is ritual. Like those families that bundle up and head for the wilderness so they can trudge through the deep, pristine snow, chop down their own little tree, and drag it, step by step, all the way home, we venture forth in the same spirit. Only we take the old pickup down to South State and find some joker who has thrown up two strings of colored lights around the corner of the parking lot of a burned-out Safeway and is proffering trees to the general public. There is something magical and sad about this little forest just sprung up across from City Tacos, and Drew and Elise and I wander the wooded paths, waiting for some lopsided pinyon to leap into our hearts. The winter Drew and I became serious. When I was a senior, and she was already in her first year at law school, I sold Christmas trees during vacation. I answered a card on a dorm bulletin board and went to work for a guy named Gear, who had cut 2,000 squat pinions from the hills east of Cedar City and was selling them from a dirt lot on Redwood Road. Drew's mother invited me to stay with them for the holidays, and it gave me the chance to help Drew make up her mind about me. I would sell trees until midnight with Gear, and then drive back to Drew's and watch every old movie in the world and wrestle with Drew until our faces were mashed blue. I wanted to complicate things wonderfully by having her sleep with me. She wanted to keep the couch cushions between us and think it over. It was a crazy Christmas. We'd steam up the windows in the entire living room, but she never gave in. We did develop the joke about condition, which we still use as a code word for desire. And later, I won't say if it was spring or fall, when Drew said to me, "I'd like to see you about this condition," I knew everything was going to be all right, and that we'd spend every Christmas together for the rest of our lives. One night, during that period, I delivered a tree to University Village, the married student's housing off Sunnyside. The woman was waiting for me with the door open as I dragged the tree up the steps to the second floor. She was a girl, really, about 20, and her son, about 3, watched the arrival from behind her. When I had the tree squeezed into the apartment, she asked if I could just hold it for a minute while she found her tree stand. "If you ever need to stall for a couple of hours, just say you're looking for your tree stand." I mean, the girl was gone for about 20 minutes. I stood and exchanged stares with the kid, who was scared. He didn't understand why some strange man had brought a tree into his home. "Christmas," I told him. "Christmas. Can you say Merry Christmas?" I was an idiot. When the girl returned with her tree stand, she didn't seem in any hurry to set it up. She came over to me and showed me the tree stand, holding it up for an explanation as to how it worked. Close up, the girl's large eyes had an odd look in them, and then I understood it when she leaned through the boughs and kissed me. It was a great move. I had to hand it to her. There I was, holding the tree. I couldn't make a move either way. It has never been among my policies to kiss strangers, but I held the kiss and the tree. Something about her eyes. She stepped back with the sweetest look of embarrassment and hope on her pretty face that I'd ever seen. "Just loosen the turn screws in the side of that stand," I said, finally, "and we can put this tree up." By the time I had the tree secured, she had returned again with a box of ornaments, lights, junk like that, and I headed for the door. "Thanks," I said. "Merry Christmas." Her son had caught on by now and was fully involved in unloading the ornaments. The girl looked up at me, and this time I saw it all. Her husband coming home in his cap and gown last June, saying, "Thanks for law school, honey, but I met Doris at the jurisprudence ball, and I gotta be me. Keep the kid." The girl said to me, "You could stay and help." It seemed like two statements to me, and so I answered them separately. "Thank you, but I can't stay. That's the best help. Have a good Christmas." And I left them there together, decorating that tree, a ritual against the cold. "How do you like it?" Elise says to me. She has selected a short, broad bush which seems to have grown in two directions at once and then given up. She sees the look on my face and says, "If you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. Besides, I've already decided this is the tree for us." "It's a beautiful tree," Drew says. "Quasimodo," I whisper to Drew. "This tree's name is Quasimodo." "No whispering," Elise says from behind us. "What's he saying now, Mom?" "He said he likes the tree, too." Elise is not convinced, and after a pause, she says, "Dad, it's Christmas. Behave yourself." When we go to pay for the tree, the master of ceremonies is busy negotiating a deal with two kids, a punk couple. The tree man stands with his hands in his change apron and says, "I gotta get $35 for that tree." The boy, a skinny kid in a leather jacket, shrugs and says he's only got $28. His girlfriend, a large person with a bowl haircut and a monstrous black overcoat festooned with buttons, is wailing, "Please! Oh no! Jimmy! Jimmy! I love that tree! I want that tree!" The tree itself stands aside, a noble pine of about 12 feet. Unless these kids live in a gymnasium, they're buying a tree bigger than their needs. Jimmy retreats to his car, an old Plymouth, big as a boat. "Police rule" is spray-painted across both doors in balloon letters. He returns instantly and opens a handful of coins. "I'll give you $31, 55 cents, and my watch." To our surprise, the wily tree man takes the watch to examine it. When I see that, I give Elise $4 and tell her to give it to Kid Jimmy and say, "Merry Christmas." His girlfriend is still wailing, but now a minor refrain of, "Oh, Jimmy, that tree, oh, Jimmy," etc. I haven't seen a public display of emotion and longing of this magnitude in Salt Lake City ever. I watch Elise give the boy the money, but instead of saying, "Merry Christmas," I hear her say instead, "Here, Jimmy, Santa says keep your watch." Jimmy pays for the tree, and his girl, and this is the truth, jumps on him, wrestles him to the ground in gratitude, and smothers him for nearly a minute. There have never been people happier about a Christmas tree. We pay quickly and head out before Jimmy or his girlfriend can think to begin thanking us. On the way home in the truck, I say to Elise, "Santa says, keep your watch, eh?"
"Yes, he does," she smiles.
"How old are you, anyway?"
8.
It's an old joke, and Drew finishes it for me. When he was your age, he was 7. We will go home, and while the two women begin decorating the tree with the artifacts of our many Christmases together, I will thread popcorn onto a long string. It is a ritual I prefer for its uniqueness. The fact that once a year I get to sit and watch the two girls I am related to move about a tree inside our home while I sit nearby and sow food. On the morning of the 24th of December, Elise comes into our bedroom, already dressed for sledding. "Good news," she says. "We've got a shot at the record." Drew rises from the pillow and peeks out the blind. "It's snowing," she says. Christmas Eve, we drive back along the snowy avenues and park on Fifth, as always. "I know," Elise says, hopping out of the car. "You two used to live right over there before you had me, and it was a swell place and only cost $72.50 a month, honest." Drew looks at me and smiles. "How old are you?" I ask Elise, but she is busy towing the sled away, around the corner, up toward 11th Avenue. It is still snowing, petal flakes, teeming by the street lamps, trying to carry the world away. I take Drew's hand, and we walk up the middle of H Street behind our daughter. There is no traffic, but the few cars have packed the tender snow perfectly. It could be a record. On 9th Avenue, Drew stops me in the intersection, the world still as snow, and kisses me. "I love you," she says. "What a planet," I whisper, "to allow such a thing." By the time we climb to 11th Avenue, Elise is seated on the sled, ready to go. "What are you guys waiting for, Christmas?" she says, and then laughs at her own joke. Then she becomes all business. "Listen, Dad, I figure if you stay just a little to the left of the tire tracks, we could go all the way. And no wobbling." She's referring to last year's record attempt, which was extinguished in the 8th Avenue block when we laughed ourselves into a fatal wobble and ended in a slush heap. We arrange ourselves on the sled, as we have each Christmas Eve for 8 years. As I reach my long legs around those two women, I sense their excitement. "It's going to be a record," Elise whispers into the whispering snow. "Do you think so?" Drew asks. She also feels this could be the night. "Oh, yeah," Elise says. "The conditions are perfect." "What do you think?" Drew turns to me. "Well, the conditions are perfect." When I say conditions, Drew leans back and kisses me.
so I press. There's still room on the sled, I say, pointing to the F inflexible flyer that is visible between Elise's legs. There's still room for another person. Who? Elise asks. Your little brother, Drew says, squeezing my knees. And that's about all that was said. Sitting up there on 11th Avenue on Christmas Eve, on a sled which is as old as my marriage, with a brake that is as old as my daughter. Later tonight, I will stand in my yard and throw this year's reindeer droppings on my very own home. I love Christmas. Now the snow spirals around us softly. I put my arms around my family and lift my feet onto the steering bar. We begin to slip down H Street. We are trying for the record. The conditions, as you know by now, are perfect. That was the H Street Sledding Record by Ron Carlson, published in his book of stories, The News of the World. The Portland police once tried to arrest a man named Stephen Donns at his home for drug possession. He didn't answer the door, so they broke down the door. There was shooting. Donns killed a police officer. He was hurt and was taken to jail, where he died mysteriously in his cell a few days later. And then a reporter for the Oregonian, a few days after that, got an interview with Stephen Donns' brother. Here's his report. Death shadowed Stephen Douglas Donns his whole life. Both his parents committed suicide. He tried to end his life several times and always vowed that if he wasn't a millionaire by 40, he would kill himself. And Donns made no secret what would happen if police came looking for him. Yeah, he said if they broke into his house, he'd defend himself, his brother said. John Danny Donns, age 36, talked publicly for the first time Friday about the life and violent death of his older brother. In a way, I think Steve's in a better place now, he said. Danny Donns paused and stroked his beard as he sat in the house where his brother traded gunfire with police. He took a roll of toilet paper from the coffee table and wiped tears from his eyes. I just wish I'd seen him before he died, just to let him know that people did love him. Danny Donns came to Portland about a year ago and lived with his brother and Jeffrey H. Moore for about 6 months, but the two had a falling out and Danny moved away. I guess because he was outspoken about everything and I didn't like the way he expressed his views sometimes, Danny Donns said. If something made him mad, he always talked about getting even. Danny Donns was sleeping two houses away when gunfire woke him January 27th. I tried to call Steve on the phone right after that, and there was no answer, so I figured there was something wrong with him, Danny Donns said. He doesn't know exactly what happened that day, but thinks his brother slept through the first few times police knocked and was surprised when they came in. The DA said Steve ambushed police, Danny Donns said. But if he ambushed police seriously, they'd all be dead. Danny Donns said his brother was intensely interested in guns to the point that he mailed suggestions to manufacturers on how to make their guns more efficient. Stephen Donns told Moore in a telephone call from the hospital that he would have killed himself the day of the shooting, but he emptied the ammunition in his gun at police, and because he was paralyzed, couldn't get to another gun, Danny Donns said. Donns' parents, John and Pat, were members of the Hells Angels in California when they met. She abused Stephen horribly, once throwing him in front of a car, breaking both his legs. Danny Donns says his grandmother told him this. Their parents later separated, and Pat committed suicide when the boys were about 4 and 5, sending them to live with their grandmother because their father was in prison. Then their father killed himself in 1992 as the ravages of alcoholism slowly ate away at his body. The last time Danny Dons saw or talked to his brother was the day before the shooting, but authorities never allowed Danny to visit or call his brother after the shooting in the hospital or in jail. Danny Dons has a message for police, whom he says he generally respects. "I'd just like to tell the families of the police officers involved, I'm sorry for what my brother did, and I think the police need to stop doing these knock and talks and harassing people," he said. Stephen Dons is not buried or cremated as of this writing. Danny Dons was trying Friday to call relatives and get enough money for a funeral.